This is The Conversation. It is episode 127 with New York-based artist Adam Schechter, maker of animation and video. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for the show is theconversationpod.com, where you can see stills from some of Adam's videos, and you can also find a couple of links to his videos, including the most recent and the most epic, called New Year from 2014, which has a finite run on the link. So you can check it out up until about the late part of February. So let's call it around the 25th. You can check it out. And after that, I think you're just going to be able to see shorter versions of it. It's just a conflict of other screenings of it, if you will. So check that all out. I want to tell you about our last episode, episode 126, with veteran Angelino Kim Abeles, who is one of the pioneers of the downtown Los Angeles loft scene and artist scene, and is, as you will find out when you listen, even if you are in New York, you'll hear about her history downtown, but also her future moving out of town, the result of the new economy, which is something I always like to talk about in one way or another around real estate. So for this episode with Adam, we talk about his video work, of course, his history in New York with a variety of challenging and sometimes impossible jobs. And we also have an interesting exchange, which I haven't had in a while, about the difference between having a day job and being able to make what you want and being able to support yourself by your work, but not necessarily being able to do everything you want because of those circumstances. So stay tuned for that. Let's get to that episode now. Thank you very much for being here. I have some more for you on the back end, so stay tuned for that, please, too. And I will talk to you then. What are some sort of bullet points, for lack of a better term, that you feel that we should definitely get to that hasn't already come up in our earlier conversation?
Okay, yeah. I think maybe, you know, I moved to New York in 2000 with the idea of, like, working in children's entertainment or animation somehow, even though I wasn't trained in that. And I got, like, kind of a job immediately doing Flash and being a receptionist. Okay, and then, you know, I got, like, through the 2000s, this idea that I did a lot of work just online. I had a site called The World of Adam, and I was doing, like, music videos in Flash.
Okay.
Because there wasn't a lot of, you know, if you had one meg, you couldn't watch videos, but you could watch Flash.
Got it.
And so I kind of did stuff for, like, different musicians in New York, like, including, like, Antonina Johnson's, and that is actually what got people seeing my work. So that is another note.
So I remember that you were in Queens from our earlier conversation. You didn't designate which part of Queens.
Woodside.
That's the neighborhood adjacent to Jackson Heights?
Yeah, that's exactly
right.
It's about three stops away.
And have you been in Queens the whole time you've been in New York or other neighborhoods?
No, I lived in Williamsburg until about 2006. I moved to New York in 2000. And I'd always actually had this weird thing for Long Island City because it was like this somewhat unpopulated place that had really great transit, but not much else. So my husband and I were there for a while. And then as it grew in popularity, we eventually got kicked out. We have this really weird habit of living above people who die and sell their buildings.
Uh-huh.
So we lost the building in Long Island City and then we moved to Woodside. And the man who we lived above here also died, and they sold the building.
Wow.
But we are rent controlled here, so we learned our lesson.
Oh, good, good. But so the man who lived above you in Woodside was your prior place at Woodside.
Yes.
Got it. Okay. What about Williamsburg? Were you kicked out of there as well?
No, I think I just kind of kicked myself out.
Too hip.
It was just, you know, it was really fun for a long time. We had this incredible apartment that, like, was like the loft, and there were great parties there. But I lived with six people, and living with six people is really fun for a while.
When you're 22.
It just wasn't fun after a while. And it's like one bathroom, and people just had kept different hours. And after a while, I was like, you know, I think it's maybe time to And also I had a boyfriend and I was like, oh, we could actually live together.
Right.
And so that was a nice transition out of that.
Right.
A full goodbye to Williamsburg. So it was all those factors.
Is the boyfriend the man who became your husband?
He did become my husband.
Got it. I kind of had a feeling.
Yeah.
So you moved to the city though in 2000. Where were you coming from?
I was living in Montreal. I went to school at McGill and I did a major in cultural studies, which I thought at the time I could actually make film, but actually it was just purely theory. Mm. And so anything we did was only, we could only do it for extra credit. But some friends and I kind of did our own thing. We had like a comic called Rumpus we were part of and had a lot of fun with. We made animations. And when I was at school, I was like, oh, I should like move to New York and do like work for Nickelodeon or MTV. Mm. And I had this really, like, when I was younger, I had a lot of, confidence in my ability that wasn't necessarily warranted, but I think it served me kind of well at the time. So I just started sending my VHS tape to the different Viacom companies, and I had like a few, like a little bit of interest, but I didn't get a job. And I ended up getting hired by this company, this web company, through monster.com. Like right away. And it was kind of like New York City dream come true because it paid like so much money to me. It was like $20 an hour and my rent was like $500 a month.
Right.
I'm like, this isn't hard.
Yeah.
This is easy. And then that was Web 1.0. So they showed me my business cards and then the next day they fired me. So it was one of those things. Yeah,
that's,
it was rough.
Now that's, wait a second. Let's not skip over this. So, Here you are, this cocky slash confident,
no cocky.
So here you are, this young filmmaker on the, a fledgling filmmaker on the make, and you head to New York, and then I suppose your confidence took a pretty big blow.
Oh yeah, it was really bad, and also I didn't have health insurance, and all of a sudden this didn't seem so hospitable or easy. Or any of these things, I was trying to get jobs, and they were doing things like, apparently I was really good at data entry.
Yeah.
And I was like, so flattered that someone was like complimenting me on something. Cause like just after applying, it was actually much harder to get a job after that kind of magic job. And, I eventually got a job working, interior visuals at Bergdorf Goodman's.
Huh.
And I had no skill whatsoever in interior design. It was just a total disaster for a year.
Is interior, wait a second, is it, just to clarify, is interior, what did you call it, interior visuals?
Yeah, like interior merchandising. So they'd be like, this room's a mess.
Right.
You need to fix this.
Right.
And I'd be like, okay. And I had no ability to do that. I was like terrible at it. but it's also one of those jobs where like, there's such a kind of corporate structure that they can't really fire you.
Huh.
So they'd kind of like heart to heart, like, Adam, you should practice this more. I'm like, I'm trying. And, it just, no one was very happy with the job that was being done.
Who was it that had the confidence in you in the first place to put you there?
HR? I don't know. Uh-huh. I showed up with, I'd really wanted to work in the windows, because there's amazing
Naturally.
People who do that work.
Yeah.
And I brought like my portfolio of drawings, like, oh, you're really, you're good with color. So you should be able to, do interior merchandising. But my thing is, and this persists as an artist, I have like no ability to work with a room. It's all very flat.
Mm.
So the idea of like arrangement in three dimensions is not my thing.
Right.
So, but then I befriended a lot of the people in the visual department in the windows, and they tried to like move me over to work in the windows, but there was like a whole kind of pissing match. It was kind of like a Devil Wears Prada kind of thing.
You were coming from film, right? Not from visual art per se.
Right.
And are you from Canada or did you just go to school there?
Oh, yeah, I just went to school there. I'm from Texas.
You went from Texas to Montreal.
It's kind of convoluted. I'm sorry. But and then I actually went to college for a year in Portland. And I'm like, this just isn't working. It was like, I it was just too expensive. Like, I should go somewhere where I won't be broke.
Right.
After going to undergrad. So I applied to McGill in Montreal and Hunter in New York. And I'm like, I took a year off. I'm like, I will go to either of these schools if they take me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got into McGill and I'm like, that will be cheaper.
Right.
So I went there.
I see.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. I just want to clarify because I think it's important to note that your background is in film. That's not like you were going from art into film.
Oh, right. And actually, my background is technically English, I guess, because the cultural studies program was largely literature, some theater, and then film studies.
Right.
So I took a lot of literature classes, which I love. But yeah, there was no art training per se.
Right.
And I wonder why I never went to art school to a certain degree, but it just kind of turned out that way.
Hmm. So you were doing data entry, you were doing some, but you're sort of not doing very well with the interior visuals.
Yes.
And what came next?
It was September 11th, actually.
Okay.
So I was working there, and I think a lot of people were like, oh, shit, like, what's it all about? Do I really want to die here? Like, do I really want to die folding a sweater? You know?
That's awesome.
And it was intense. Like, people just kind of, everyone was kind of, like, shuffling around. Like, there was, it's hard to imagine it now to a certain degree, but there was a lot of soul searching where people were like, I don't know if I should be doing what I'm doing with my life right
sure.
now because I could die, you know, next week. So, you know, at that time, I was like, I really don't like it here. And I remembered my favorite high school teacher, Mr. Prevedal, had always told me, you know, you should be a teacher. He's like, he said something along the lines, like, you won't hate yourself. You get your summers off and you can have time to do other things that you care about.
Mm.
So with that in mind, I'm like, I'm going to get my master's degree. And I was like, what's a good master's program in New York? And there's a few schools, but one of them is called the Bank Street College of Education. And they're kind of known among educators as kind of like the most kind of progressive. And they're also the most affordable, the ones I was looking at. So I enrolled and I just started teaching from that moment, like being an assistant teacher and then kind of working my way up.
Mm-hmm. As far as accreditation or credentials and that kind of thing.
Yeah. It was a kind of a fun school in a certain way because they have a very kind of interesting history. Like the woman who, and if I'm getting this wrong, someone can correct me, and I hope I got this right, but The Runaway Bunny was written by a Bank Street founder graduate. I might need to fact check that. But they have a really proud history of like working with like public television and like developing really cool things. And one thing they're really good at is like they have like the best art program of like any school I've ever seen in my life. Like the kids, their work is just so raw and connected and beautiful because they make time for art all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so inspiring to see the kind of work that was being done at every age. And like they were like masters of paper mache that the projects had been making by third and fourth grade were just mind blowing.
Huh.
And I really loved that.
So you were able to get an education at this school, and then they basically funneled you into teaching at this school. Is that how it worked?
Yeah, I was an intern for a year there. And then there's like a whole network of private schools in New York that like kind of try to hire people from Bank Street. So I got, I went to a school called F School Culture, and I taught there for a number of years. And I was an assistant. And during this time, I'd been making my art. And as my graduation time was coming up, and it was, you know, people were starting asking me, you know, like, when you're going to apply to be a lead teacher, I realized I didn't really want to be a lead classroom teacher. And it gave me a little bit of a panic attack because that meant that this art that I'd always kind of done on the side or talked about but never really fully committed to was kind of like rearing its head. And I had to start to try to make a decision of what I was going to do. And then around that time, actually, an artist who was also an assistant teacher named Stephanie Diamond told me that I should apply because she knew I was an artist, said, you know, you should really apply to this school called Skowhegan.
Ah, and got it. And by the way, was this friend of yours, and were other people there also, you know, visual artists on the side kind of thing, or how did that work?
There were maybe two or three of us. It wasn't really like a big magnet for it, but there's definitely a huge crossover, people working in education and artists, especially in elementary education, I'd say.
Okay. Got it.
So she mentioned the school to me, and I didn't really, I hadn't heard of it. And she's like, oh, and by the way, the deadline's tomorrow. So I scrambled, I got the application out, and I got on the wait list.
Uh-huh.
And I was really excited, and I was like, oh, maybe this is something I can do. And I didn't get in.
Wow.
But something about that, it made me realize maybe, you know, I should start focusing on this more.
Right.
And I don't need to just go into a public school, be a full-time classroom teacher, and because for some reason that's what I should be doing, you know, and putting my art as like a thing I do on the side, you know.
And just to clarify, because I think my and maybe a lot of people's perception of Skowhegan is that it's very painting, you know, slash drawing oriented. Where does film come into their program?
I think, I mean, at this point, it's like anything goes. I mean, they have like a full range of stuff. But, you know, when I was there, they definitely expanded their the fields they considered to video, performance. Basically kind of anything you could get an MFA in, they would consider.
I see. Okay. So you didn't get in at that time?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
And then I applied the following year and I did get in.
Okay.
And that was a really good thing for me. I think that for me really made myself, it forced me to treat myself, my work more seriously. And it also gave me a network of people that weren't just teachers. And I just got to make new friends that only knew me from Skowhegan forward. So I wasn't like the teacher who also makes art.
Right.
You know? And that was great.
Yeah. Yeah. And did that going there make you think that you might want to go to grad school, or was that really sort of all you needed? That's my sense.
You know, I definitely thought about it, but I also felt old. I was 29. But I think also I was just broke. It wasn't really in the cards.
Right.
So I think all those factors coming together helped me make that decision. I mean, I definitely considered it for a number of years after, but it didn't really seem like the right thing for me
right.
at that time.
The thing that you're making me think of is the picture I'm getting is that you were responsible for your own finances, that in contrast to a fairly predominant model of the young emerging, you know, fledgling artists, which is one in which they, you know, have sort of more of a financial fast track to grad school and what have you. Is that fair, or is it maybe more that because you weren't doing the artist track, you were doing sort of the film / education track? That, do you see where I'm going with that?
Yeah, no, I mean, it was interesting too. You know, there was a wide range of people there. There were people who were still in grad school, some who hadn't gone to grad school. And then there were people who, you know, I was 29 when I went. I think the oldest person there was 43.
Mm.
And there was a real range of attitudes about it, about the time being spent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think among those of us who lived in the city and were kind of in the grind,
right,
like it was just like, it was so precious, you know?
Right.
And I think some of the younger people, you know, yeah, you know, you're just doing your loans and everything, you know, you're not thinking about what things cost and, you know, what opportunities there are, maybe as much, I don't know. But I think for us older folk,
right,
it was like, shit, I don't want to waste this. This is really great.
Right.
So yeah. And you know, my thing is I have this thing about security. Like I've always been like a bird in the hand.
Yeah.
So I have friends who freelance or, you know, adjunct, and that concept terrifies me. The idea of just figuring it out, like where the paycheck is going to come from in 3 or 4 months. Mm. I couldn't handle that.
Right.
So I've always kind of sought job security in that kind of way and made my work around the constraints of that kind of structure.
So you're teaching technology then. You are teaching full time, correct?
Yes.
Got
yes.
it. And is it the same school or is it another school that you mentioned earlier?
No, I moved. I'm at an all boys school now.
Mm. Where's that?
It's on the Upper East Side.
Ah, okay. A name we maybe shall not mention.
Yeah, I talk to my kids about this, about not disclosing information online.
Right, so, right.
I mean, it wouldn't be that hard to figure out, but I'm not going to say it.
No. I'm not going to put a hashtag, Upper East Side mm-hmm. private boys school next to your Instagram post. So don't worry about it.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, you bet. The reason I ask actually is because, I just wanted to clarify the picture. So here's the big question that comes to mind, when you have that kind of, the first big question for me is how much work do you have outside of the class and, the day at school as far as preparation and any of that kind of stuff?
I try as hard as I can to leave work at work.
Good. Right.
As time goes by and I take on new responsibilities at this job, that gets eroded a bit, and like I find myself like checking my work email before going to bed and things like that, and like
right.
making sure certain things are operating. But it is my goal to kind of make sure that, I manage my time well enough that I leave my work behind me when I
right.
go home.
Right. I think this is a good time maybe to kind of flip forward, because the thing that I thought of is the gallery where you show your films / animation, however you want to term it, which is 11 Rivington, right?
Yes.
And I'm a mad.
They moved, so now they're 11R.
11R.
Like rebrand.
Formerly of 11 Rivington. Are they still in the Lower East Side?
They are. Just don't go to 11 Rivington because you won't see anything.
Got it. Okay. So this gallery you show at 11R, I just am picturing the artists, your fellow stablemates, as many of them being, full-time artists. Is that impression anywhere near correct, do you think?
A lot of them are professors as well. A lot of them teach
right.
in MFA programs
right.
in the city or upstate.
Right.
And there's definitely ones who are full-time artists, but I think there's a fair amount of those who are in the education system as well.
Oh, okay. All right. So you don't feel like you're the overworked, working class kind of artist in that group necessarily?
I don't think so. I mean, it's just it's a grind, living in New York and work. I feel like I know very few artists who make a living primarily off their work. And even those I do think of, it's like a stress case. It almost seems harder to me,
right,
than having this job that you do, and then you also get to do your work.
Right.
So, I mean, in a certain way, I mean, I kind of envy that, like the idea, like, oh, you can make a living off your art, and at the same time, like, I don't think I will. I guess I'm just very ambivalent about the idea,
yeah,
of what that would entail. I think it sounds good. I think for both people, they're like, oh, it's so nice you can do your job and then just do your work. I'm like, oh, it's so great that your job is your work. And I think both are correct in a certain way.
I think that's very healthy, because I think my tendency, and I think a lot of artists' tendencies, is to envy full-time artists. But as you're pointing out, the reality is for many of them, I think some of them are actually quite healthy with their balance. I mean, indeed, many of them, as your stablemates, you pointed out, have MFA type jobs, or college teaching, but it's not.
Yes.
It's definitely as a general rule, much, much less time-consuming than a full-time job type situation that like yours.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing that's funny for me is, some people are like, I just really need to be in my studio. I need the full day to work. I need, all these things. And for some reason, probably because ever since college and I was making work, it was always I needed to do everything first before I made my art. Like for me, I work very incrementally. It might be an hour, it might be 2 hours, but it just adds up.
Right.
So, in a lot of ways, I, I mean, I would love to work less. I could go to the movies and like relax and like experience New York City.
Right.
But I only have a certain number of hours in me to make work, and it's actually not that high of a number.
Right.
Per day.
Yeah, yeah.
It might be 2 hours. So that's just kind of like my adaptation, or maybe just my personality that makes this work, I guess.
Do you track like the you know, the labor involved in your animation or your films, you know, as far as I know it's going to, you know, I'm going to be done by this month or that kind of thing? Or do you try to sort of more just play it as it goes?
I try to play it as it goes. I do have like general deadlines in mind, but I usually try to like add, you know, another 4 or 5 months to whatever I think it's going to take.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like being pressured to do things, and I right. like to like kind of let things unfold.
Right.
Well,
let me phrase it another way, because what yeah. I was thinking about, you know, your long New Year, your long piece, and
mm-hmm.
imagining that that a lot of time went into making that. And so
mm-hmm.
when you have just 1 and 2 hour chunks, or, you know, say you have roughly, I don't know, 12 hours a week or something like that,
mm-hmm.
do you think about, okay, if this is going to be my average output, it's going to take me, you know, 6 months, 12 mm-hmm. months, 14 months, that kind of thing?
Yeah. I don't really think that way too much, because what I usually just go is like, okay, I want to have something finished in 3 years
right.
from this point. And it tends to kind of work itself out from there, where I might be really productive over the summer or at some other period in time, because I feel like what I used to do was I'd be like, okay, I have to work 2 hours a day. And that 2 hours could be just smashing my head against a wall. But for some reason, I thought like, I feel like not all studio time is equal
mm-hmm.
in a certain way. And I've learned more for myself. If it's not there, I'm not going to push it, because all I do is aggravate myself and mm-hmm. like get a little like down.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to kind of just, if it's there, I'm going to work. If it's not, I'm going to like back up. And I think that served me, has started to serve me a lot better, because otherwise I'm just kind of, like performing for someone who's not there, the idea of like being in the studio, like, oh, I was in the studio for so many hours today, like, who gives a shit? You know, like,
is your studio like an office in your apartment, or what is your studio like?
Yeah, I have a setup in my home. I had a studio for a while that I ended up giving up, because I started to realize that it was nice to have a private space I could go away to, and like the mind space of it, but
mm-hmm.
I needed money for my videos that I need to allocate for other things. And so I just traded that off to like carving out a little space
right.
in our home.
Right, right, right. And your studio consists of a large Mac and a laptop, that kind of thing?
Yeah, basically.
Right.
Which, you know, in a certain way can be a little limiting, because like recently I did a three monitor piece, and I didn't get to see what was happening until we actually installed it. I was just kind of guessing.
Right. Right.
You know, because I didn't have the materials. I was like just trying to kind of mock it up in After Effects and hoping it would work. So there's definitely like a downside to it, but,
yeah,
you know, the benefits outweigh it. For now, I'm like my big screen and my laptop.
Got it. And since you did mention After Effects, just for people who are curious, program wise, what are the programs that went into New Year, for example? Which is your by the way, your most epic piece, or not necessarily?
Yeah, it's the most kind of, it's the largest thing I've tried to pull off. And it took the longest, and it took the most resources, and
right.
I did things I hadn't done before. So yeah, that was my kind of like my push that I did. But I used After Effects for it. I shot a lot of footage like with just a regular camera. I built some miniature sets, and then I used I did 2D animation using Flash.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Just like a combination of all those things together in different ways.
Right, right. And you mentioned when we spoke earlier that Flash was actually kind of your specialty early on when you were doing animation work, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, I was really, when I came to New York, I was really, really into kind of, they call it limited animation. You know, kind of like Sesame Street, jazz boppy, kind of very graphic animation, and doing kind of very limited cutout kind of stuff when I was in school. And then when I moved to New York, I got a job as a receptionist at this web company, and I learned Flash during that time. And it just felt like a perfect fit for my style, and it just made sense to me. So I definitely was using it all the time. And it was really fun for me because, you know, back in 2000, 2001, I'm not sure if you remember Loading Bars, but, you know, I started making these music videos that I could share, and they were 1 or 2 megs. And so you could share 2 or 3 minutes of visual content with people in a way that was impossible at the time if you're actually using video or something else.
So you were so you share really you shared them with Loading Bars? Is that what they were called?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you knew that you would have 35 to 40 seconds for someone if they were going to, you know, watch a 1 or 2 meg video.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So
does any of the Flash and the style that you were talking about, you know, the jazzy or whatever, poppy kind of thing, is that, do you feel like that's at all a precursor to GIFs, or is that, are those completely different schools?
That's a good question. I mean, I think the GIF has been around longer, and it's actually more durable because in a certain way, like I tell like younger artists, I work in Flash, like, oh, that still exists. People still use that. They're
right.
Like, kind of horrified. And it makes me worried. I'm like, I hope it doesn't get phased out. So there's some relation, but you know, with the GIF, there is like this window of time that you can only make it so long. Whereas
right.
with Flash, you can make like, you know, a TV show.
Right, right, got it. You reminded me with the, you know, the Flash that they still use that, of this this woman on this other podcast that I heard recently talking about. She has toddlers and she's trying to show them as many films as she can, you know, that are actual talkies before everything becomes virtual reality programming.
Oh God.
You know,
yeah.
and that like a regular film is just like, you know, the sort of silent films of our time kind of thing.
Oh, that's a terrifying thought.
Yeah,
yeah,
it really,
I mean,
is.
The idea of like you make this environment and just kind of set people loose in it versus,
right,
like for me, I'm such a control freak with my video. Like I want this shot at this angle with for this amount of time.
Right.
Yeah. It's interesting to see what the fate of that sort of language is going to be. I mean, I tend to think we'll be okay. I mean, to me, okay. I mean, maybe people don't care at all if that's the future or not, but I think storytelling does have its place, and I hope we'll continue to like read novels and follow the hand of the artist as they kind of like share, you know, either visually or narratively, and unfold their stories. Maybe we can coexist, I hope.
To what extent in your teaching job do you have to kind of keep up on that stuff and or even introduce some level of it to your students, the virtual reality stuff?
It's the expense of it has kind of kept it at bay for
right,
now, but
right.
It's starting to come in. We've been talking about, what's it called? Google Cardboard.
Mm.
That there's like VR, like it turns your phone into VR glasses.
The one that was sent out with the New York Times recently.
Yeah, that's the one.
Right.
And like sharing that with the kids. But I maybe in 5 years. It's going to be more of a thing than it is currently.
Right, right.
It's definitely, you know, I mean, the thing that's really coming up is this whole idea of like 3D printing and coding and, you know, like a language and all that stuff is like, there's this movement called STEAM that's become very popular, which is science,
what's
technology,
that?
Engineering, arts, and mathematics.
Oh, okay. Right.
And that's a good thing. It's trying to teach kids to like, get their feet wet and to like, it's kind of like a little bit of humanities thrown in with arts and engineering and like really getting through the whole picture. I hope it lasts. I think it's a good frame for getting people actually involved instead of just like, you know, I mean, rigidly segmented, you know, now you're going to math, now you're going to art. You
right.
know?
Do you have a 3D printer at your school?
Oh yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. What is using that like?
it's an emergent technology. It's kind of a nightmare at times. I mean, when you look at a 3D printer, you can kind of see what it's going to be like in 10 years.
Right.
But as of now, like a kid will finish a project, like, great, let's print it. And you like press the button. You're like, okay, we'll come back in 12 hours and see if it worked, you know?
Right.
And half the time it didn't.
I see.
They like were off by 1 degree on their, you know, model.
Right.
So, it's interesting to kind of see what early adoption looks like and then like kind of projecting forward in sort of sci-fi sort of way, like, oh, but I know what this is going to be. And, you know, we're going to look back on this moment like, oh, it used to be like you'd wait 12 hours for this, just like a modem to, you know, DSL.
Right.
But for now, it's not like you can't really use it in like a major way.
So when artists are making 3D sculptures, you know, that they're exhibiting,
mm-hmm.
are they then getting that work outdoors at a relatively, for now anyway, high-end place where they're going to have to invest a pretty substantial amount of finances in it?
I don't know. I mean, mm-hmm. my short answer is yes, but I don't know what they do instead.
Right. Okay.
Got it. But, you know, when they're talking about like, oh, you know, it'll be funny because I'm not working. So I'm like, oh my God, you know, they just printed someone a new nose, or like they're printing like kneecaps using 3D printers. And I'm like, not these 3D printers.
Right. I see.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not, I mean, it makes a good headline, but it's not, you know, super high end, you know, locked away somewhere. It's not entering a school in the foreseeable future.
Right. So you went to Skowhegan. If I could go back to your arc for a second, you went to Skowhegan and that sort of introduced you to, or sort of solidified your being an art maker. I wanted to get to the point where your work got introduced to the art world context.
Well, the thing that was happening for a while is, even when I moved to New York in like 2000, 2001, 2002, I would be in like group shows and I was showing like the animations I made. And like I made, a lot, I was really into music videos and they were bands that I really liked and I would talk to them and ask if I could use their music and they'd say yes. So for example, I made a series of animations for Antonina Johnson's and he was really great about letting me use the work, and it got distributed kind of widely because the internet, you know. And I really enjoyed doing that, but I felt like people were like, oh, that's a really great song, you know. And I felt like kind of constrained by the creativity of someone else's work. Although I was interpreting it, it just didn't feel like it was mine.
Right.
But at the same time, that was the work I sent to Skowhegan. And that's what got me in. So it was, I had been showing in group shows and with fellow artists, but I felt like it was just at a certain level that I wasn't happy with anymore. And it was after going there that I started to say to myself, well, maybe I shouldn't be making music videos. Maybe I can make work that isn't dependent on like a soundtrack,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
So while there, I think that's the kind of break I made. And after I did that, I just started, like, I made a few cold calls to people I'd, you know, shown my work with in group shows. And I got my first solo show in Miami with this really unpleasant gallery. But it was a start.
Wait a second. So I think you sort of described why, right? Because you said,
yeah.
I made some cold calls and I got a solo show. So the odds that you would have us get that solo show and it would have gone great, it would have been like, how did you do that? You know?
Yeah.
How was it bad?
Totally.
In one or two words.
Well, I guess it wasn't a cold call. It was just, I've been in a group show and I was like, hey, I just got back from this residency, I have some new work. I'd love to show it to you. And he called back saying, hey, cool, do you want a solo show? And I said, that was easy. And then
right.
And then it wasn't.
Right.
So but you know, I had those early experiences of being like, this isn't exactly what I want. This isn't really great. But at the same time, I just got some practice in. And actually because of that show, it was during like Miami and during a Art Basel, and Augusto from 11R, I bumped into him like, hey, I have a piece up in this group show or this gallery I'm showing stuff with. He came by and that kind of also helped move that along. So
right.
I shouldn't complain too much, but it was you know, it was a weird experience for sure. The early steps.
Did they not know what they were doing? Were they just hard to work with? Was it a combination of all of those things?
I think they're just, yeah, it was a little hard to work with. And, you know, it was just like being in a bad relationship.
Right.
And I'm like, I should break up with this person. And they're like, I'm breaking up with you. Like, wait, I was going to do that.
So, oh, wow.
That's it in the short story.
Got it.
But everything else since then has been pretty good, you know?
Yeah. I guess the one thing I want to ask you about your work, because it's film,
mm-hmm.
in a gallery context, is A, do you want them to be shown in film festivals? And B, what kind of expectations do you have of the viewer who's coming into the gallery and, you know, that they're going to sit for 10 minutes to a half hour to watch your whole work?
Yeah. The work I made before this new year, the longest piece I ever made was 6 minutes.
Right.
And I've when I'm making work like for a gallery, I always try to think of the fact that I don't know when they're coming. I don't know how long they're staying for.
Right.
And I want to actually plan for that. So a lot of the work I used to make, or still do make, I like to have multiple points of entry and think about the way that something can need to be watched several times to reveal itself and to have different layers to it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually really important to me to plan for the gallery setting. I mean, I don't know. I haven't really shown a lot in film festival settings. I think sometimes you just get on a roll in one direction and just people kind of see you that one way.
Right.
But I do structure, I try to make it both. Like, it does have a beginning, middle, and end. And yet I hope you can, like, it's like an onion skin. You can come in for like, you can watch it for 30 seconds. You can watch it for a minute. And I hope to plan or make it so that there's something in each one of those types of viewing.
Right.
I mean, that's my goal. I'm not sure what people actually take away, but I do try to be aware of that.
That makes sense to me. Yeah. That's kind of what I intuited. You know, I didn't necessarily put those words to it, but I think that meets my experience.
Mm.
Yeah. So speaking of gallery audiences and your work, what is the thinking or the concept around marketability or, you know, the objecthood, you know, of your film and that kind of thing, the market for your animation? Does that get complicated?
Not for me so much, because, you know, I just want to keep making the work, and that what I'm mostly looking for is like a place to show it. And I haven't really felt with the gallery, they've always been very supportive of everything I've done. And for me, that's kind of like why I have my job. Like, there's no universe in which I can make the pieces I make and make a living off of them.
Sure.
And so I don't know. It's a tricky thing. And like, you know, videos are editioned with two APs, but it's all such a construct. You know, you could put on a thumb drive that can like a million copies immediately. And I think that the whole, it's been the struggle of video art to be like, how do we sell this? I'm not sure if that answer has really been made. And it's something that has affected the music industry. It's affected, you know, commercial film. And I think it also, to me, kind of explains this kind of explosion of, I feel like painting's not dead, you know?
Right.
It's like, well, painting is a commodity. You know, there can be one of them. Whereas in like digital media and video, like, how do we convince people this is something that's precious? You have to convince someone to support the artist or believe, you know, basically like back it, rather than that, well, you're getting this one of a kind thing. Cause it's not one of a kind, you know?
Well, Christian Marclay managed
the work.
Christian Marclay managed and his people managed to convince a few collectors that the work was pretty valuable, right? For one example.
Oh yeah, totally. And like someone like Charles Atlas, you know, I think is just one of the, you know, greatest video artists ever, you know, but also they've been working for a very long time. So I think
part of it is also building this body of work that people understand and see the progression of and then want to get behind.
Right.
So for me, I guess it's just like, I want to keep making my work. And I hope that when you look at it, you start to see the story of how we went from A to Z, you know?
Yeah.
And I look at, to use the musical analogy a little bit, like I kind of see like my early videos are like my four tracks. And now, you know, like they're getting more like and more involved and sophisticated, but I hope that DNA is evident through it.
Right.
And I'd like to share that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think lastly, I think it's the thing that you said at the beginning was, which is a really important point that has a sentiment that I've heard on this podcast very rarely though, which is that in order to really be responsible with the work that you make, you need to not depend on it for your living.
Mm-hmm.
That the real integrity is in making kind of the decision, whether by accident or very purposely, that, you know, your work is your work and you have your day job so that you don't have to worry about the market.
Yeah. I mean, a couple of other things that came to mind was like, you know, I'm working on this new piece. I'm calling it Satellites. And it's this kind of long form, very unwieldy thing that I'm trying to like kind of rein in. And what I started doing is anytime I'm doing a group show, I'm calling them like studies. And I'm actually using that as like my deadline to do miniature portions of the piece and present these sorts of like sketches of it. And that's been like, that's my new approach in a way of like presenting work while not being finished. The one thing though, and this is also along the other line, but like making a body of work is that, you know, as a video artist, like I don't understand, or it seems very painful to me, the idea that like a painter can make these beautiful works and then never see them again.
Right.
That like, I can't conceive of that. Like, it just sounds so hard to me. And the thing I love about my videos and making them is like, I don't have to say goodbye. Mm-hmm. I can make them and I get to keep them with me and share them if I want. But then also, you know, I have my version as well that I could tell it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It doesn't like, I don't lose it when I put it out or finish it. And that's really important.
That's a great, that's a great observation of the sort of the converse of the assembly line painting sort of angle, but your work leaves, disappears,
mm-hmm.
you know, but, and you get this money or, you know, something along those lines, whereas yours is sort of the opposite.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Well, I know you have a your teaching job to get ready for, so I will let you get to that. But in the meantime, thank you so much for taking the time, Adam. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for talking.
Absolutely. And we're out. Have a good night. Thank you very much again to Adam. He was really on the ball, I think, in every area, including getting this video to you. So I hope you go check it out if you haven't already. New Year, it's up for about 10 days from when this comes out. So like I said, about the 25th of February. And I want to remind you that this is a listener-supported show. Your support of the show is very much appreciated and in some cases necessary. You may have noticed that we have moved to once a week. And for those of you who are new listeners, we are now putting out episodes once a week, which is quite a pace. So your support of the show, ideally financially, is very much appreciated. You can donate quite easily through theconversationpod.com. Click on the Donate Now button. It takes you to PayPal. You can also send a check if you want the address. I will be happy to give it to you. You can also support the show by spreading the word, letting everybody you know, and you know, getting them to give it a listen. You can also leave a nice review on iTunes, which is linked through the site. And you can, of course, follow the show on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, all as well linked through the site. All right. I wanted to give you one little thing to go on. I meant to mention this at the beginning, but for those of you listening in New York in particular, well, anybody actually who gets the New York Times, have you noticed these very predominant ads for this painter? I'm not going to even mention the name because they don't need any more promotion than they've already given themselves with all these ads. But there was actually a pull-out little mini catalog type thing or brochure a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, every week for the last month or so in the New York Times, right in the middle, pretty decent sized ad for this guy's paintings and his website and catalog as well. And I just, it kind of just rubs me the wrong way, and I'm sure it rubs you, a lot of you, the wrong way. I just want to know if any of you know if that kind of thing works. When you have the advertising budget for that kind of coverage, if it's actually going to give result in returns, or if it's more of an exercise in, you know, promotional narcissism. So would love to know specifically on this particular artist if you know anything, or generally what your feelings are about that. Conversationpod.com and social media. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoy this episode. I appreciate you being here and listening, and I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.